Hello and welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Trinitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Follicular Lymphoma, and this is part two, and it's new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and making treatment decisions, and very important areas for us to cover today. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and it's really that collaboration that really has allowed us to reach so many of you. We also have some other cancer organizations that have collaborated as well, and so we really have a lot of you on the call today. We have over 723 participants on the call today from all of the United States and from all different regions, and we have international participants from Canada, Greece, Jordan, and the United Kingdom, so a bit of an international call as well. I'd also like to say that this program is supported through an unrestricted grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Spectrum Pharmaceuticals, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today and for this entire series. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be covering. And there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And there is an evaluation form, which we ask you to complete at the end of the program. Indeed, it is your recommendations that really help to inform our programs and keep them relevant to meet your needs. So please do take that moment and complete that evaluation form. We very much rely on your suggestions of topics. Indeed, the specific topics for this particular series is one that has come from each of you, so that you've asked us to do this program. So we really take your recommendations quite seriously. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Stephanie Gregory. Dr. Gregory is the Elodie Akem Chair of Hematology, Professor of Medicine, Rush University Medical Center, Rush University. And Dr. Gregory is going to address updates on the treatment of follicular lymphoma, new treatment approaches, and she's also going to address communicating with the healthcare team about making treatment decisions. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Gregory, who'll also start by a brief discussion or description of follicular lymphoma. Dr. Gregory?
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here. Welcome, everyone. I enjoy these programs so much, and I would give you a brief overview of follicular lymphoma. Lymphomas are increasing in incidence, and the follicular lymphomas are the second most common non-Hodgkin lymphoma. In general, we'd like to think of the follicular lymphomas as a chronic disorder rather than an incurable disorder. I think that some patients certainly can be cured with follicular lymphoma, certainly with stem cell transplants, and we really are making this disease more of a chronic disorder that, you know, we'll have to have some treatment periodically. Remember that the follicular lymphomas present in many different ways, and there really is not one standard of care. So, you know, if you go to your physician and you have follicular lymphoma and he says, this is the treatment you should get, you know, you need to say, well, what other options do I have? We always look at the patient with follicular lymphoma as to whether they're symptomatic or not symptomatic. And if you're newly diagnosed and are asymptomatic, we look at your workup, we look at your CAT scan, we look at your blood test, and then we decide whether or not you have what we call low tumor burden. And if you have low tumor burden and you're asymptomatic, the treatment of choice may be no treatment at all, but close observation. So I think it is important to realize that every patient does not need chemotherapy right away. If we do watch and wait, and then you are seen by your physician, and the two of you decide you may need some treatment, the only treatment that you may need is single-agent immunotherapy. And so single-agent rituximab has been used repeatedly for patients, again, with low tumor burden. And the question is whether or not once you have 4 weeks of Rituxan, some doctors use 8 weeks. I tend to use 4 weeks. remember, this is immune therapy, and you should be reevaluated maybe two to three months after to see if there's a response. If there is a response, you and your doctor may talk about maintenance treatment. And I think one of the important studies that recently came out is that there probably is not a benefit to going on Rituxan maintenance after single-agent rituximab. You can probably have just as good a response if you wait until your disease comes back a little bit more, and then you get 4 more weeks of Rituxan. And so that came out of something called the RESORT trial for low tumor burden. On the other hand, if you have high tumor burden, your lymph nodes are pretty large, you're beginning to get symptoms, your blood counts aren't entirely normal, then we certainly recommend chemoimmunotherapy. And again, I said there's no standard of care, but many of the regimens available are drugs like a CVP regimen, Cytoxan, Vincristine, Prednisone. Less commonly today, except in Europe, is the regimen called CHOP with rituximab, which has an anthracycline in it, the red medicine that you can get that can perhaps have some cardiac side effects. And then a newer drug that's been used is a drug called bendamustine. And actually a recent trial looking at the comparison of bendamustine with Rituxan versus R-CHOP, Rituxan with CHOP, the authors presented data supporting a better response with the bendamustine Rituxan. I always like to say to patients, but if you don't need treatment, don't get it. If your disease comes back after these treatments, you don't necessarily have to rush in and be treated again. If you're not symptomatic, you don't necessarily need treatment. I do think that if you get what we call a complete response, all of your disease goes away, your disease may stay under control a bit longer than if you only get a partial response, which means when you repeat CAT scans, all the lymph nodes have not disappeared. So again, many options for treatment for both low tumor burden and higher tumor burden. When the disease relapses, I think it's important to know that there are some novel treatments. Radioimmunotherapy is a treatment that's over in 1 week. There's no hair loss. The responses are wonderful. They are actually much higher than single-agent rituximab. And a recent trial actually looked at adding radioimmunotherapy to frontline treatment after you've had chemotherapy. So, again, that's another option for frontline treatment if you don't want to go through so much chemotherapy. I've been giving abbreviated chemoimmunotherapy like R-bendamustine or R-CVP, maybe 3 or 4 treatments, and then consolidate with radioimmunotherapy, 1 week of treatment. Other doctors may choose to give you two years of rituximab maintenance after your chemoimmunotherapy. And that came out of a trial called the PRIMA trial. And patients who get 2 years of maintenance rituximab after chemoimmunotherapy tend to have their disease stay in remission longer. So these are some of the treatment approaches that have been, you know, fairly recognized by our physicians. There are many novel approaches today, and I think that we have to really think about some of the emerging agents that are coming out to treat this, really, this chronic disease. What we don't want to do is we don't want to over-treat patients, because if you get chemotherapy every single time your disease comes back, you can harm the bone marrow stem cells. And if we harm the bone marrow stem cells, you can get secondary cancers. And the secondary cancers that we worry about is something called myelodysplastic syndrome, which is really a pre-leukemic disorder. And we certainly know that in years past, 4 or 5 different chemotherapy regimens caused about 4 to 6% of patients getting these secondary cancers. So today we are looking at novel agents, perhaps agents that are not chemotherapy. And some of those newer agents are newer monoclonal antibodies. We know Rituxan is a backbone of all the treatments for the B-cell lymphomas, but now we're looking at some newer monoclonal antibodies against some other proteins on the surface of the lymphoma cell. And they're not quite ready for prime time. They're in clinical trials still, but there's an anti-CD22 monoclonal antibody that is attached to a toxin that seems to give some good responses in low-grade lymphoma. There are some other newer and more efficient rituximabs that are out there today. They help the immune system kill the cancers a little bit better. We know that there are also some novel agents that affect the microenvironment of the tumor cell. They don't necessarily kill the tumor cell directly, but they work in the soil. Remember, the seed is the cancer cell. The soil is the microenvironment, and the microenvironment helps cancer cells grow. So if we can attack the microenvironment, we may be able to get rid of the cancer cell. And one of those drugs is called lenalidomide, and that's a derivative of the old thalidomide drug, and we know that it works very well in many, many ways in helping cancer cells to die. There are other new agents today actually directing and looking at the cancer cell and what makes that cancer cell grow. And we know that some of the things that make cancer cells grow are totally deregulated. It's not like a normal pathway in a normal cell. So we've developed new little pathway inhibitors, and many of them are pills that you can take by mouth. They're referred to as PI3K inhibitors. There's another one called a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and I know these sound a little foreign to you, but I think in the near future, many of these pills are going to move fast forward, be available, and perhaps we can combine those pills with perhaps the lenalidomide and the monoclonal antibody rituximab, and sort of make cocktails of pills that don't include chemotherapy. Now, I'm not saying everyone doesn't need chemotherapy. The patient whose disease comes back very rapidly, and especially if they're young patients, I think there's a role for transplant. So that's just a brief overview of some of the treatments that have been used for follicular lymphoma, some of the novel agents that are out there, and also the fact that any patient who relapses quickly after their first or second treatment should discuss the role of an autologous bone marrow or stem cell transplant with their physician. I'd like to move on just for a few minutes about communicating with your healthcare team. It is very important that you know exactly what you and your doctor are talking about as far as treatment. First of all, I always tell my patients, I want you to know exactly what kind of a lymphoma you have. So if I ask a patient, what do you have? And they say lymphoma, I'll say, what kind of lymphoma? If they say non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, I'll say, that's not enough. Then they'll tell me they have a B-cell lymphoma, and I'll say, that's not enough. You need to know that you have a non-Hodgkin's B-cell follicular lymphoma, because every lymphoma is different. And the more you know about your subtype of lymphoma, the better you're going to be. Ask your doctor questions. Ask what the side effects of the treatment are. Ask what the long-term side effects of that treatment may be. And you need to really maintain a very strong support system. Make sure that you have someone in your life, a family member, a friend, that will come with you and hear what the doctor is saying. You know, everyone gets down a little bit when they have a diagnosis of lymphoma and they have to go to the doctor and they have to get treatment and they may lose their hair. It's normal for all of us to be depressed at some point in time. Get help. Ask for help. You also need to deal with the changes that may occur in your body. You know, if you lose your hair, it will come back. I always say don't go get a wig right away. Just, you know, put pretty scarves at home. Don't wear that hot wig at home if you don't need it. If you go out, that's fine. Really try to have a healthy lifestyle. Work out if you can, but don't overdo it. You need to realize that you're not going to be able to do everything that you could do before you were getting treatment. And I think that if you really have a good relationship with your doctor, you're open with each other, get the results of your laboratory tests, know what your CAT scans show, but don't hover on every single word in those results because most of them don't mean a thing. So I think that's the advice I'd like to give you about really a good communication with your healthcare team. There is a great deal of hope for follicular lymphoma. I'm sure we're going to cure this disease, and certainly right now we've made it more of a chronic disorder, and patients are living longer. We have improved overall survival. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gregory, for an excellent and inspiring presentation, really, and for setting the stage for all the information about follicular lymphoma. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Jeremy Abramson. Dr. Abramson is Director of Lymphoma Program, John and Joe Ann Hagler Chair in Lymphoma, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, and he's also Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Abramson is going to address the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Abramson.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you to the Cancer Care Organization and to the Lymphoma Research Foundation for inviting me to be part of this exciting program. And, of course, I'm honored to share a virtual stage with Dr. Gregory. So in building upon the beautiful framework that Dr. Gregory has laid out, I want to think about clinical trials and talk to you about how they can inform your care as well as, of course, informing the care of all of those of us who walk in our footsteps, just as clinical trials have informed the current standards of care that we all have at our fingertips today. I think in choosing treatments, I would echo exactly what Dr. Gregory said, which is at any juncture point, either with newly diagnosed disease or with disease that's gone into remission and then is being followed and considered for additional treatment at relapse, it's always important to think, what is the great landscape of options available at our fingertips? And I think the most important thing to always address as an initial consideration is whether any treatment is required, as Dr. Gregory pointed out. And there are a great many people we can observe, and we know from clinical trials that have actually randomly assigned people to treatment immediately or treatment only when the disease was larger or symptomatic, that the average time for people needing treatment with observation might be 3 to 5 years away, during which time all that we're going to talk about with clinical trials may actually end up yielding newer, less toxic therapies that would be preferential to therapies that might be available at the time of immediate diagnosis. And so we always think about observation. We then think about standard treatments that are available at our fingertips. And when we think about standard treatment options, we always want you to recognize, as Dr. Gregory pointed out, that there are numerous treatment options available, and that treatment in follicular lymphoma really needs to be tailored to the patient in front of us, that every patient's follicular lymphoma can be a little different, and certainly every patient is unique, and that means other medical issues or lack of medical issues, other medications they might be on, and how many side effects and what types of side effects people might consider optimal for them. And so in considering the patient and the patient's underlying type of follicular lymphoma, we can think about antibody treatments alone. We can think about antibody treatments combined with chemotherapies. We can think about radioimmunotherapy that Dr. Gregory pointed out. And then the thing that I think is important always to think about is clinical trials, that clinical trials should always be considered as an option for treatment at the time that treatment is being entertained in follicular lymphoma. And so right now we'll focus on a bit of an introduction to the clinical trials process and how you can put clinical trials into a framework and try and decide if they're the right thing for you at any given time, but always ask about them. Clinical trials, in brief, are really the engine for medical progress. All the standard treatments that Dr. Gregory has already talked about are treatments that are considered standards because they've been demonstrated in clinical trials to be safe and effective for follicular lymphoma. And so without clinical trials, we would have no treatments available because we wouldn't know actually their side effect profiles. We wouldn't know if they're safe, and we certainly wouldn't know if they're effective. And so how do we decide to take a drug into a clinical trial? Well, invariably, we identify a drug at the scientific level that appears to be active against lymphoma cells. And this could be evaluated in petri dishes and test tubes of lymphoma cells. And then new drugs are given to small animals and larger animals to determine if they're safe. And they're even given to animals that actually have lymphomas injected into them to see if they can work. And once that happens, they're taken into a human clinical trial. So even before a new drug for lymphoma actually reaches a patient. There's been extensive work, years of work, at the level of the laboratory to determine if the drug is biologically suitable at treating lymphoma cells, to make sure that when that drug is exposed to lymphoma cells that they can work, and to ensure safety in animals before they get put into human beings. And so in that sense, everything really that's going into people has had a lot of evaluation even before then. And that's how we get to the clinical trial stage. And once we're in a clinical trial, we use these to answer very specific questions about new therapies. And it's not just drugs. It can be vaccines or devices, though we don't really use devices in the setting of lymphoma treatment. We determine whether these new drugs are not only safe but effective. And they're not just limited to single drugs. We might have existing drugs that we've used for many years and then have newer drugs, and we want to see if they can be combined. And just because we've got a new drug available to us doesn't mean we automatically know that it's going to be safely combined with existing therapies, or that it's going to be just as effective when combined with other therapies. And so some clinical trials aren't of new drugs. They're of older drugs in combination to see if those combinations are both safe and effective. And when we look at these clinical trials, you'll generally hear them about them described in three major phases. And so I want to talk about the phases of clinical trials. There are three major phases that you will hear about: phase one, phase two, and phase three. A phase one clinical trial, as implied by the number, is an early clinical trial. And the real question for a phase one trial is a new drug or a new drug combination safe in human beings, and trying to define what the safest and most effective dose of that drug is in human beings. So a phase one trial will usually test different doses of a drug in a small number of patients and evaluate safety and determine the dose. The primary goal of that study is not to show how well a drug works. That's what we do in a phase two study. In a phase two study, a new drug or a new drug combination is given at a dose that's been shown in a prior phase one study to be the best dose, to have the best potential side effects, or rather what the most effective dose is at the safest level it could be given. So in a phase one trial, a drug could have shown that it shrank every lymphoma, but if it did so at such an unacceptable level of toxicity, then a lower dose of that drug would be taken into the phase two study. In the phase two study, a larger number of patients are enrolled onto that study with a given disease to see how well that drug works. And I'll talk a little bit more about phase two trials. And once that is shown to be effective in a phase two trial, the next question is a new drug or combination as effective, better or worse, than an existing standard of care? So, for example, if you've got a new drug, say it's called bendamustine, no longer a very new drug, but certainly a drug that's been very popular. And that drug is then combined with rituximab, and we have phase two trials showing that rituximab and bendamustine produces encouraging responses and long remissions in follicular lymphoma. Well, next, the natural question is, okay, that looks like it works, but does it work any better than R-CVP? Does it work any better than R-CHOP? And a corollary to that, of course, is it better tolerated than these other regimens? And so phase three trials are then conducted to compare one treatment to another. And ultimately, it's a phase three trial that usually will lead a new drug or combination to show hopefully superiority, or occasionally what we call non-inferiority, which means it works similarly to another drug but maybe has fewer side effects. And then those ultimately lead to new regimens being approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This process that we're talking about takes a lengthy period of time. And on average, from the time a first new drug is developed in a laboratory, it takes about 5 years for that drug to be developed, to take in through animal testing, and then phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials before that new drug gets FDA approved and available for human beings. And so it is a lengthy process. How do we decide initially how to take those drugs in? Well, we look at a few different things that's important, and that's that we assess that a new drug is biologically plausible against follicular lymphoma, And so that could mean for the new antibodies that Dr. Gregory was talking about, that follicular lymphoma has a protein on the surface called CD22 or CD19. And that would make it biologically plausible that a new antibody against one of those proteins might be effective. We'd have to have a reason to expect that patients will benefit, meaning in animal models, for example, it appeared to shrink the tumors or in test tubes. And then we have to have an expectation that it will be safe. And that's where animal safety testing and ultimately then the phase 1 clinical trials have shown safety. And then we need to determine the dose with which to take forward in the phase 2 and further trials. And so that's a general overview for phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trials. And all of these phase trials are available to patients at different points in their diagnosis. Now, usually in the clinical trials process, a new drug or a brand new drug combination will first be tested in patients who have relapsed disease or what we call refractory disease that has stopped responding to standard chemotherapies. And the idea here is that if we have an unproven drug, we want to first prove some degree of benefit in patients before giving it as their very first treatment. And so most clinical trials of new drugs are in patients who've already received prior therapies. And these are often clinical trials testing drugs of either new antibodies, of new what we call pathway inhibitors, such as the Bruton's tyrosine kinase or PI3 kinase pathways, or potentially drugs that manipulate the environment around tumor cells by increasing the immune response against the lymphoma cells themselves, including things like lenalidomide and including engineering the body's own T lymphocytes to attack the body's own lymphoma cells. And so these are often tested in relapse disease, and at the point that they're shown to be effective in relapse disease, they're often taken forward into newly diagnosed disease to explore it as initial therapy. One good example of that is the combination of lenalidomide and rituximab, which showed encouraging responses in patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma, and then was put into a phase 2 clinical trial in patients with newly diagnosed follicular lymphoma who needed treatment, so not necessarily at the time they were diagnosed, but at the time that their disease had grown sufficiently to be symptomatic and require therapy. And in that initial phase 2 trial, the response rate to these drugs is very high, of over 90%, with the vast majority of patients having what we call a complete remission Without exposure to traditional chemotherapies. And based on those very exciting results in previously untreated disease, there's currently a phase 3 randomized trial where patients in that trial are randomly assigned to receive either standard chemotherapy, such as rituximab with bendamustine, versus the newer therapy of lenalidomide plus rituximab. And so how do you decide whether to participate in a clinical trial? And I think this is always a very personal decision and something that always requires careful discussion with your doctor and your care team. And I think one initial question to ask your doctors is, what clinical trials are available to me right now? There are virtually always trials available at various stages of one's follicular lymphoma, but they might not always be the best option for every patient at every time. So important to say, what are my clinical trial options? What are my standard chemotherapy options? Is observation an option right now? And then weighing the risks and the benefits of each of these approaches as far as deciding whether to proceed with these trials. If clinical trials are not available at the setting that you're being treated at, then it's worth asking where the nearest center is that participates in lymphoma clinical trials and getting an opinion on what trials might be available. You can also investigate on the internet, you can search a national website called clinicaltrials.gov, which is a registry of all available clinical trials. And you can search for follicular lymphoma and by geographic area and find out where clinical trials are being conducted, and then investigate with your doctor and with doctors at those institutions if clinical trials are right for you. I think there are a lot of reasons to participate in a clinical trial. This is a way, as a patient with either relapsed disease or newly diagnosed disease, to potentially have access to a very promising new drug before it's commercially available. And so it is a way to potentially have an opportunity to have a newer, very exciting treatment before it becomes a standard of care. But the tentative clinical trials is that we haven't proven that yet, which is why it's still a clinical trial. And so it's important to recognize that a clinical trial may or may not ultimately help your particular lymphoma. The goal, of course, is that it will help your lymphoma and that it will define a better and safer treatment strategy for those who follow in your footsteps. And I think that's a very important reason to participate in a clinical trial. We wouldn't offer it if we didn't think it could potentially help your particular lymphoma, and we thought it was a good option at that time. But it will also, doubtless, help every follicular lymphoma who walks in your footsteps, just as the patients who walked in front of you in their care in follicular lymphoma participate in trials of rituximab and of bendamustine and of radioactive antibodies such as Zevalin and Bexxar and all the exciting agents that are currently at our fingertips like lenalidomide and others. And so I would encourage you to explore clinical trials as an option at any time, to ask your doctors about clinical trials, to do some research yourselves and ask targeted questions about that, and find out if and when clinical trials would be an appropriate option for you to participate. And then I finally want to close with a comment about quality of life concerns. This is a very general term, consideration of quality of life, and something we obviously take very seriously. As Dr. Gregory pointed out, follicular lymphoma is a disease with a very lengthy natural history, and our goal for all of our follicular lymphoma patients is that they live a completely normal life expectancy, and that their length of life nor their quality of life is impaired by this particular disease. And that means that quality of life has to be a critical and central concern. And that means that choice of therapy has to be chosen with the understanding that with the disease, that will be a chronic medical process, hopefully well in the background of one's life, that the treatments that we use to treat the disease don't unduly impair the quality of life because there are so many different treatments available. And so always consider treatment and ask about treatments in the setting of how will they affect your quality of life? Are other therapies or newer therapies available, or might they be available in the future that might preserve quality of life better than existing treatments? Because ultimately, it's very important that you think about your own life and the long life ahead in order that the treatments that we have, both new and old, can help not only ensure your length of life, but also preserve your quality of life. And your medical team of nurses, doctors, social workers, pharmacists, as well as your family and friends should all be working together to ensure that this happens hand in hand with your lymphoma therapy. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Abramson. It's a wonderful presentation, very informative. Thank you. And our next speaker is Brian Tomlinson, and Brian is the Chief Program Officer for Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Brian is really the architect of this program today, both in terms of its content, our speakers, as well as just really helping to access support for the program. So I can't thank Brian enough, and I'm going to turn the program over to Brian because he's going to describe the free support programs and services offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Brian?
Well, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to you and your colleagues at Cancer Care for just a wonderful partnership over the last close to 15 years on all the calls we present for people affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. I'd also like to thank Dr. Jeremy Abramson and Dr. Stephanie Gregory for their excellent and very clear and informative presentations. They both did a fantastic job. These two individuals speak for us all over the country and participate in a variety of our programs. So I thank you on behalf of the organization for all that you do for us, as well as for the patients that you work with. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the supporter of today's call, Spectrum Pharmaceuticals. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding innovative lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. Each year, we invest millions of dollars to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The Lymphoma Research Foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through our aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, the organization has funded over $51 million in research, which includes over $9 million specific to follicular lymphoma research, and more than 43,000 people access our programs and services each year. LRF provides a comprehensive series of programs and services for people dealing with a lymphoma diagnosis and their caregivers, including a lymphoma helpline where professional public and mental health staff can assist you in your search for information, resources, and other support. You heard Dr. Gregory talk about new agents and Dr. Abramson talk about clinical trials. The organization does have a clinical trials information service that can assist you in your search for additional information about clinical trials. We have a Lymphoma Support Network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. We offer a variety of print and web-based publications and newsletters, including comprehensive disease guides, disease-specific fact sheets, including two fact sheets specifically to follicular lymphoma, as well as relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, and an informational e-newsletter dedicated to follicular lymphoma. We have a variety of webcasts and podcasts that are available on the different types of lymphoma, treatment options, and support issues, all available on our website. We have a disease-specific follicular lymphoma website, which offers disease and treatment information. You can access that website by visiting www.focusonfl.org. On that site, you can visit it and sign up to receive news, an LRS follicular lymphoma disease-specific e-newsletter, and the organization sponsors a variety of in-person patient conferences on the local, regional, and national levels. For more information, please contact a member of our lymphoma helpline by calling us at 1-800-500-9976 or visiting our website, lymphoma.org. Again, thank you to Carolyn, Dr. Gregory, Dr. Abramson, and Spectrum for supporting today's call. Carolyn?
Well, thank you very much, Brian, just for really helping everyone understand the services that they can access from the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Thank you so much, and for all that you do as well. And now our next speaker is Maria Chai, and Maria is Clinical Supervisor at Cancer Care. Maria is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. Maria?
Thank you, Carolyn. As an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to talk about the emotional and social impact of lymphoma and how Cancer Care can help you. When you're first diagnosed with lymphoma, it can be an overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices and may not know where to turn. Talking to a Cancer Care oncology social worker can help you get the support you need. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. One of the most important things to acknowledge about the emotional impact of lymphoma is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways for both patients and caregivers. That's why it's so important to have an outlet to acknowledge how you're feeling and have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and understanding. This can mean talking one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker or joining one of our support groups. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as phone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by lymphoma, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. Group members offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with, additional support and guidance. Finally, lymphoma can have a significant impact on your finances, and for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect of lymphoma. Cancer Care provides limited financial assistance to help with transportation to treatment or help with home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with the costs of lymphoma. While we may not be able to resolve all the problems you're facing every day, Cancer Care social workers provide a listening ear and the ability to counsel you as you navigate the cancer experience. Many people living with lymphoma find this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you to feel that you're not alone. So please contact us at 1-800-813-4673 or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support.
Thank you very much, Maria, for just a wonderful presentation about our services and about the role of oncology social workers. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So, Trinitha, could you explain to the audience how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered, or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Ron R. Your question, please.
Well, I was wondering, in some types of clinical trials, there might be two arms where one particular drug has twice the effectiveness of duration before there's any progression of the disease. So you're disease-free for maybe twice as long as another arm of the drug. My question is, sometimes the overall survival is the same. How is that possible?
Well, that's an excellent question. Dr. Abramson, would you like to address that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And Ron, I think that's an excellent question, and it really gets to the heart of often how we weigh the optimal treatment approaches at the time that we have them to select from, because there are often a lot of options. And one thing you'll hear us talking about relative to clinical trials that have been done are the endpoints of those trials. Any clinical trial has an endpoint that it is seeking to define, and that's how that trial measures success. And for trials such as phase 3 trials, which are comparing one regimen to another regimen, you'll often be looking at a couple of different things. One might be response rate, meaning what percent of patients in each treatment had their lymphoma shrink down by, say, more than 50 or 75%. But what you're asking about is really something called both progression-free survival, meaning how long the disease stays in remission before it starts to grow again, versus overall survival, which is how long patients are alive. And, of course, the ultimate goal of all of our treatments is to ensure overall survival, is that patients are alive and well. And what we will often see, and what has been true since the dawn of time with follicular lymphoma trials, is that when you add additional treatments and compare them to treatments with, say, one drug, and so if you add treatments with more intensive therapies, two drugs, three drugs, compared to one drug or two drugs, what we will often see is that you'll see higher response rates and a longer progression-free survival in people who get more treatments, meaning the more intensive the therapies, historically, the longer those remissions have lasted, meaning a longer progression-free survival. However, what's also been shown repeatedly across these studies is that generally the overall survival is identical, meaning just because you can induce longer remissions doesn't mean people necessarily live longer. Now, how could that possibly be? That seems like a paradox, as Ron points out. And because what happens is this disease often remains sensitive to therapy. And so if you can imagine that people have are given one treatment, and let's say it's a treatment with chemotherapy plus rituximab, and that patient gets that treatment, and their remission lasts 4 or 5 years, which is a nice lengthy amount of time. Another patient gets, say, rituximab alone. Now, that remission might last only 2 years, but at the time that that disease progresses, guess what? They can then get the chemotherapy and ultimately get to the same place, because then let's say they're in remission 3 years later and they've gotten to exactly the same place as the person who got more aggressive therapy up front. And this is why, if we think in the big picture of follicular lymphoma, we have to choose treatments that are both effective in inducing remissions and keeping them there, but have manageable and tolerable side effects that preserve quality of life. Because usually in follicular lymphoma trials, with the exception of regimens without rituximab, containing regimens compared to regimens with rituximab, which is really the only setting in follicular lymphoma where overall survival has been improved, which is why everybody gets rituximab with their treatment now. It's important that you understand that overall survival may not be changed by a given treatment, and so you have to balance those treatments by assessing quality of life in addition to the duration of remission.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that wonderful answer to that question. Excellent. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Denise G. Your question, please.
Can you tell me what percentage of patients diagnosed with follicular lymphoma are placed in watchful waiting, and what are the range of years that people stay in that category? Thank you.
Well, Great question, Denise. Dr. Gregory, would you address that?
Yes, thank you. So we actually had a study called the LymphoCare study that was published in around 2006. And I have to say that was before the common use of bendamustine. And at that time, I think the percentage of patients who were watched and waited was about 19%. And those patients that were given rituximab right at diagnosis was about 13%. And Dr. Abramson addressed this. At least from that study, it was about 3 years until the patients went on to receive any form of therapy. So 19% of patients, at least from a very large observational study and patterns of care study published in 2006, said that about 19-20% of patients will select with their physicians the watch and wait type of observation.
Can you comment on that discussion with the physician in terms of how that might...
Yes, you know, I don't think one should be coerced into treatment just because their physician says you should. If he says this is my recommendation, then you need to question why. Sometimes doctors get a little bit nervous depending on the what the pathologist sees under the microscope. There actually are three different types of follicular lymphoma. They're graded 1, 2, 3, and actually 3 is divided into A and B. Anyone that had a follicular grade 3 was felt to have a more aggressive type of follicular lymphoma. They often receive treatment like a more aggressive lymphoma. They often would receive Rituxan plus CHOP chemotherapy. We now know that there's a subtype of the follicular grade 3 where actually patients, if they're not symptomatic, don't necessarily need treatment. It acts like a low-grade lymphoma, and if they do have low tumor burden, they can also be treated with rituximab alone. So I think it's very important for patients to always get a second opinion. One patient came to me recently with a follicular grade 3. The physician wanted to use R-CHOP. We evaluated the patient. She was asymptomatic. She didn't feel comfortable not receiving anything, and we selected to choose 4 weeks of rituximab alone for that patient. She's now a year and a half out and has not had any further treatment. So again, it's a decision that you need to make with your physician, and if he's making a recommendation, you need to know why. You know, do I have high tumor burden? Do I have any blood counts that are worrying you? Is there a symptom that you think I have? So a good discussion is very important with your physician.
Excellent. Thank you. And thank you, Denise, for that question. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Susan S. Your question, please.
Yes. Thank you so much for an excellent discussion. I wanted to know, for someone who's in the wait-and-see period, what are the very earliest warning signs that treatment will be needed? And is there anything else that the patient can do to lengthen this period besides the healthy lifestyle?
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you. And Dr. Abramson, would you like to address that?
Sure. Well, I think that's an excellent question. To take the latter part of your question first, what can you do to ensure that you can be observed for as lengthy a period of time as possible? I would say nothing has ever been proven to actually make this watch and wait period last longer. No diet has been shown to be particularly better or worse. You'll see lots of things advertised as immune stimulants and such, and none of them actually really work quite like that. And so I tend to counsel my patients to live and enjoy their life, to not treat themselves like a sick person because they're not sick people, to enjoy their life absolutely the fullest because the disease itself will generally follow its own course, and if and when it requires therapy, that those treatments are available. I think it's very important to recognize that something like the LymphoCare study that showed that about 19% of patients were put in watchful waiting, that might in fact be informed a lot by also doctors' own preferences and patients' own preferences. But I have to say in my own practice, many more than 19% of patients, when I meet them initially, will be put into an initial surveillance category. And what we find when we watch follicular lymphoma over time, and I might get a CAT scan a couple times a year for the first couple of years to get a sense of what any person's own follicular lymphoma is doing, is there's a lot of heterogeneity across it, but most of them will behave a very late lazy and indolent course. And in fact, follicular lymphoma can follow a waxing and waning natural history, meaning it can get a little better and get a little smaller or bigger over time. And it's very common that I'll get a routine surveillance CAT scan, say 6 months after their prior scan, and the radiologist interpreting the study will report that all the lymph nodes have decreased in size, consistent with response to therapy. And the joke's on them because we haven't done any therapy. That's just the natural waxing and waning course of follicular lymphoma. And so over time, the disease might get a little smaller, might get a little worse, might get a little smaller. Now, how do you know when treatment is really required? Well, the truth is there usually doesn't reach a point where it's 100% absolutely necessary that's treated then and there. You often enter a window, at which point treatment would certainly make sense, and treatment is probably going to be required within the next 6 months or so, and you can then consider the timing therein. What might those reasons be? Well, one might be that the disease is getting larger over time to a significant degree. And if we find that people are having what we consider bulky disease, disease that's either growing large and uncomfortable because it's under their arms or it's visible in their neck, or it's within the body pushing on organs where it might be impairing their kidney function or their liver function, for example, which we can see on blood tests, that would be a reason to treat. I'll note in that if there's an area growing larger than other areas or growing particularly fast in follicular lymphoma, one thing we always consider is that there's a very small chance on the order of, say, 1 to 3% per year for any given patient that a follicular lymphoma can transform into a more aggressive lymphoma. And if there's any suspicion of that, we do a biopsy to confirm that, and then we do treatment, of course, for the more aggressive lymphoma. Other reasons would be progressive fatigue, or fevers and drenching night sweats, which, though not common in follicular lymphoma, can happen. And the other would be low blood counts from the follicular lymphoma in the bone marrow, which is the factory for the blood cells, decreasing the blood counts and either causing fatigue from anemia or risk of bleeding due to low platelets. And so the answer to your question is really a complicated one, because follicular lymphoma might need to be treated for any number of different reasons. I think what you can do is paying attention to how you're feeling. Are you getting more fatigued, for example? Are you getting any uncomfortable lymph nodes? But your doctor will also be feeling your lymph nodes and checking your blood counts and your liver function and your kidney function. And it's all of this together that helps determine when the timing is right to initiate therapy. And when in doubt, talk to your doctor and say, these are the symptoms I'm having. But remember that patients with follicular lymphoma can have their lymph nodes swell up because they have a cold, and patients with follicular lymphoma can get tired because they're doing all sorts of things that make everybody else tired. So it's very important to understand also that other things will affect your body, and I don't always assume that it's automatically related to follicular lymphoma, but if you're feeling ill or unwell or tired, talk to your doctor and consider whether that might be related to the lymphoma.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Abramson. This is a wonderfully balanced perspective for everybody on the call to understand, and it's very helpful. Thank you. And our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Barry M. Your question, please.
Yes, thank you. This was an excellent program. Much appreciated. I happen to be one of those people who has two different blood cancers working. The first was I have CML, chronic lymphoid leukemia, and I'm being treated successfully with Gleevec. And all my numbers are pretty normal. Now, about 8 years later, I came down with this problem, with follicular lymphoma, and I'm on a watchful waiting mode. Doctor checks me out regularly. My question is, looking at trials, clinical trials, would I automatically be eliminated from any clinical trials because I have the other cancer to deal with as well? And secondly, when it comes time for me to have treatments, will this CML treatment interfere in some way with the current treatment?
Gleevec.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Excellent question. Okay, thank you so much. And I'm going to ask Dr. Gregory if she would address that question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, and you mentioned your diagnosis was CML, so that's a chronic myelogenous leukemia, so that's a myeloid disorder, and now you've developed a lymphoid disorder called follicular lymphoma. And wisely, the follicular lymphoma is probably asymptomatic. You do not need treatment. In the question of whether or not you could go on a clinical trial, Most clinical trials will say that if a patient has an active second malignancy, that they are not eligible for a clinical trial. We have several patients who have double malignancies and of the hematopoietic system. Right now I have a patient who has multiple myeloma and marginal zone lymphoma. I have another one who has Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia and multiple myeloma. So we are seeing these, and unfortunately when you have two malignancies that are active at the same time, you are not eligible for clinical trials. Perhaps by the time you are required, well, treatments required for your follicular lymphoma, and you need to remember, like Dr. Abramson said, that may not occur for a long time, and especially with the waxing and waning of the lymph nodes that can occur in follicular lymphoma. But if you do require treatment, it probably will not interfere with your treatment for your CML. We have no evidence that, say, rituximab alone would ever interfere with the Gleevec. There are some reports of patients on rituximab that have a lower white count than normal. I mean, that obviously is going to be monitored throughout your treatment along with your Gleevec. It certainly would not affect the molecular response that the Gleevec has given your CML that's not interchangeably with your follicular lymphoma. Now, if you require chemo immunotherapy for your follicular lymphoma, and again, I have treated several patients with two malignancies. They don't seem to interfere. Patients seem to tolerate the treatment very well. They are really two different diseases at the present time. And one, you know, we always are more watchful. We're a little bit more concerned, but we have a fairly large experience in treating two hematologic malignancies at the same time. I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Thank you. And there is a question, is Rituxan considered a chemotherapy?
It is not. It is immune therapy, and that's why I'm hoping with some of these more, you know, non-toxic agents that we won't see the side effects from chemotherapy.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank our speakers. You've actually been extraordinary, and I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such great questions, which really have enhanced our call today. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So as we're about to conclude the program, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with follicular lymphoma or cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that you can access services from the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care, and we're here to help you. So most importantly, please take advantage of all the services that you've heard about today. Call us if you have any questions that you didn't get to ask. We're happy to help you. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.